I'm going to talk about something very specific, which is the process that I encountered doing my current research project that just finished. And even within that, I want to talk about a very small subset of it, which is I want to talk about the ethics of doing archival research. And so I'm aware that not all of you are doing archival research, and for those of you who are, maybe the nuts and bolts of archival research may be more useful than the kind of meta ethical questions. But I'm so taken by the ethical dilemmas that I've encountered doing this that this is all I can think about. So what I will do is talk for not the whole, I don't think I'll take 25 minutes, but I'll talk about the ethics of archival research, especially in conflict studies. And then maybe I'll leave a little bit more time for people to talk to me and ask me more general questions for those of you who are not doing specifically this kind of research. But in some ways, this is also a biographical necessity. Like Ty said, that's all I've been thinking about. So, you know, I want to share. So, archival research, as you all know, does not usually include direct interaction with living subjects. But the ethical issues surrounding this method are no less acute. These issues are even more profound in the field of conflict studies, where the likely questions researchers hope to answer in the archives are often questions of life, death, murder, culpability, responsibility, punishment, or remorse. So identifying answers to such questions is a process rife with ethical minefields, including possibility of unfair affiliation of individuals with violent groups, or a tendentious interpretation of past documents, or even avoidance of specific archival material if it causes direct and irreversible reputational harm. So what I want to talk about is trying to identify some of the most significant ethical concerns that arise while I was doing archival research on conflict. So I want to discuss specifically the relationship between ethics and truth or truths in archival research, such as, for example, questions of whose voice is present or absent in the archives, and the ethical implications of such findings, as well as ethics of archival access, the politics of archives, and the power of archives gatekeepers. And so I want to illustrate all this with some of my own experience as I was doing archival research on my current book project on Holocaust remembrance in post-communist Europe. And the book is finished and coming to bookstores near you, hopefully in the fall of next year. So I want to begin by saying that archival research ethics have not been sufficiently problematized. There is an assumption that archival research is tedious, but relatively simple. The researcher identifies the archives that may have sources useful for the project. She goes to the archive, she reads the materials, she makes copies, and then she uses them as evidence in the research project, which then ultimately gets published. That's kind of how we understand archives. Now, some disciplines, such as history, for example, with so much of the work is archival, or English, or literature, have attempted to deal with issues of ethics in archives. But IR, political science, general conflict studies have so far remained largely silent on this issue. So I'm, again, going to touch on only some specific issues I encountered among a vast array of ethical problems doing archival research. So to begin with, I want you to think about archival research as there's more to archives than some dusty paper depository somewhere in Europe. That's like archives. In Germany. Much of what is archival research is video archive. For example, for the stuff I was working on, oral testimonies, oral histories, taped. So it's a visual archive that I have to watch. Archives of old TV shows, films, documentaries. All of this is archival research, and it all presents a variety of ethical problems that should be discussed. So one way to begin to rethink the ethical dimension of archival research is to think of the papers we discover in the archives as people and not only artifacts, and to recognize the personness of archives themselves. So the first problem that an archival researcher may encounter is the issue of context. within which a particular archival document is embedded. So what can one piece of paper tell us without a story around it? What do we do with someone's party membership card? So we may know this person was a member of a party, it's a communist party or a Nazi party, and this may be on its face incriminating, but we don't know much else. Was party membership coerced? Was it voluntary? Was this a choiceless choice? What inference can we make out of this one document? What other corroborating evidence do we need? Is this one document enough to make an argument about this person in our writing? What is the historical context in which this document was produced? If these are, for example, court proceeding minutes, what was the context of this trial? Was this a show trial? Was it a trial with due process? How much stock should we put in a document like that, or in witness testimony from such a trial? Then the politics of archives. How did these materials get there? Who gave them? Were they stolen? Were they taken? Are they themselves a result of conflict or coercion? What do we do with archival material of dubious provenance? What do we do with colonial archival libraries? Was there a political reason for these materials to be deposited, to be opened at a specific time? And then what rights do the dead have? So legally, and I had researched this, at least in the United States, the dead don't have many rights. They have even fewer rights if some of their personal archives or parts of it have already been made public, like some published personal letters, for example. But even if they don't have legal rights, we should have ethical concerns about writing about the dead. They can no longer provide context. They cannot assert their wish that a document not be made public. They may have changed their mind about something they wrote about, and we would be publishing their thoughts that may not be representative of what they actually believed. Archival documents can permanently shatter someone's reputation, and the stakes for us as researchers of getting it wrong are huge. Reputation may be damaged even if we don't publish the document, but just seeing it ourselves may forever change the perception we have of someone. And what if we do get it wrong? Do we have an ethical obligation to the live descendants? Should they have a say in what can be accessed and what can be published? Should we make an effort to contact descendants before publishing a dead person's document, like a letter or a diary? Reputational concerns. Archival material can cause significant reputational damage when unflattering documents, pieces of writing, or testimonies are uncovered. So to what extent should we treat differently documents about public figures and how public is public versus, quote unquote, regular people? But in the context of conflict, everybody's implicated. Everybody's a victim or a perpetrator or a helper or a bystander. So how do we sort out the reputational damage done to people by uncovering their role in the conflict, even if their role is a passive one, a bystander? Is documenting bystanding of significant enough public value to accept this reputational damage? And what about reputational damage to descendants of people we investigate? Should we worry about them? So now I want to give you some examples of all of these issues, especially the language, tone, and tenor of archival material. And this kind of gets to the emotional aspect, a little bit of what Ty was talking about. So in the course of this research on my book on Holocaust remembrance in post-communist Europe, I came across, and I also purposefully looked for, archival material, some previously published, some not, from victims, perpetrators, and bystanders during the Holocaust in Eastern Europe. I have used letters from camps and ghettos, post-war trial proceedings, oral testimonies, as well as interviews that I've conducted with descendants. So I want to give you an example of a published diary that I had to grapple with how to use. So this is what I'm going to read next. It's an entry from a diary by Kazimierz Sakowicz. So he was a Polish journalist who lived in a village next to a forest outside Vilnius, capital of Lithuania. And outside that forest, between 1941 and 1944, around 72,000 Jews were shot in horrific circumstances. They were asked to undress, hand over their valuables, then they were shot. Children were often buried alive, and they were shot by Lithuanians under German orders, but all the shooters were Lithuanians. So this Polish journalist who just happened to live there meticulously documented daily shootings and buried his diary in lemonade bottles in his garden. Now, he was killed probably by Germans, but unclear how. He was just found dead in the forest in 1944. And only many, many decades after the war, his diary was uncovered, and it was not published until 1991. So this is this entry that I want to talk about. Quote, "The Lithuanians throw the clothing onto a pile. Suddenly, one of the Lithuanians pulls out a child from under the clothing and throws him into the pit. Again a child, and again another. In the same way, into the pit. One of the Lithuanians stands over the pit and shoots at these children, as we can see. What is this? The desperate mothers thought that in this way they had saved the lives of the children hiding under the clothing. Evidently, they expected that when the clothing was collected, the children hidden in that way might be saved. Unfortunately." End of quote. So the way in which this diary entry is written, it indicates a very flat tone from which we can infer, or can we, his general indifference to the Holocaust, by so-called Holocaust by bullets, because in Lithuania people were shot, they were not sent to camps, which was going on in front of his house. Did he just not care? Was he a typical bystander? But why did he document all this? Why didn't he try to help someone? But we can never know this, because he's been dead for 74 years. And he never explained his reasoning for documenting these shootings. Maybe he was very upset. Maybe he thought of himself as a helper by documenting the killings. So how should I contextualize this diary, and how can I ethically use this as material? In other words, I don't know, what is it that I'm reading? Am I reading a bystander just observing this and saying, oh, this is very unfortunate, and then keeping it on? Or am I reading a helper who was trying to portray for somebody else the atrocities? I don't know what I'm reading, so I don't know what to do with it. I don't know if I can use this. Second example. So again, I'm going to read you an excerpt from a letter. So this letter is by Hilda Deitch. So she was a 19-year-old Jewish nurse from Belgrade, Serbia, my hometown. And she was interned at a Semlin concentration and death camp in Belgrade. She managed to write four letters from the camp to her friends. One was on the eve of reporting to the camp, explaining that she said, I'm volunteering to go to the camp. And then she wrote three from inside the camp, before she was gassed in a mobile gas truck. So the Germans in Serbia had this mobile van. So it was kind of a truck where they retrofitted the exhaust pipe and put it inside. So they would put between 50 and 100 Jews into this truck and then turn on the engine. And so this exhaust would go in and they would get gas. And so this truck would then drive around Belgrade and everybody could see it. And then they would dump the bodies on the outskirts. So this was all in 42. This is even before Auschwitz was fully functional. This is the very first gassing anywhere in Europe. Now, this is the issue that I have with the letter. So the first letter, which I'm not going to quote here, is hopeful, optimistic. She recalls fun times she had with her friends in their high school literary society. She talks about how she says, I'm volunteering to go. Everything's going to turn out okay. I'm a nurse. I want to help people. I'm going to see you again. I believe nothing bad is going to happen. So then she wrote three more letters. And this is the last letter, her fourth letter before she was killed. It is full of anger, accusation, and hatred of her fellow inmates. So I'm going to read you an excerpt. "We're all becoming evil because we're starving. We're all becoming cynical and count everyone else's mouthfuls. Everyone is desperate. But in spite of this, no one kills anyone because we're all just a bunch of animals that I despise. I hate every single one of us because we've all fallen as low as we can go. I put up with everything that's happening to me calmly and painlessly. But the people around me, that's what upsets me. It's the people that get on my nerves. Not the hunger that makes you weep, not the cold that freezes the water in your glass and the blood in your veins, nor the stench of the latrines, nor the wind. Nothing is so repulsive as the crowd of people who deserve to be pitied, but who you are unable to help and can do nothing else than put yourself above them and despise them." So, this letter is raw in its desperation, anger, and despair. It is without a doubt of historical significance. Very few letters of camp inmates have survived. It is also obviously of human significance because it details the process of dehumanization and deconstruction of social norms that happens in the worst possible environment imaginable. But is it fair to Hilda Deitsch? Had she lived, would she have liked to be remembered this way? Or would she have recoiled at her own words and feelings? So what is the curatorial choice we make in publishing this letter versus her first letter, which was full of optimism and hope? So again, I don't know what to do with this. I can tell you what I did with all of these things later. But I really, really struggled with this. And my last example is a personal archive of Milivoje Jovanović, who was the first head of the Belgrade Special Police Unit under Gestapo in the first 3 months of the occupation, from April to July 1941. So his personnel file includes orders he gave under German occupation instructions to create a specific Jewish affairs subunit, which was to administer the registration of Jews, enforce the wearing of yellow armbands, and monitor compliance with a host of anti-Jewish measures that were introduced immediately upon German occupation in April 41. Now, his personnel file also includes a biography page, which he himself has filled, or at least signed, which I obtained, in which he lists his basic biographical detail, marital status, but also in response to the question of whether he has any Jewish blood, he answers, "No, I'm pure Aryan." But that was a weird and not a very typical answer. In Serbian language, Aryan is not used. That's not part of our language. So what does this tell me? I read personnel files of his successors in this position. And in answer to the Jewish blood question, they don't say Aryan. They say, "No, I'm Orthodox Christian." So why did he write Aryan? Was he a true believer? Did he think this is what the Germans expected, and he overcommitted to the cause because he was the first chief of special police? Well, his successors realized they didn't have to speak the Nazi language to succeed. I don't know. His archival file, however, also includes a lot of exculpatory evidence after the war from a number of high-placed communists who testified that he had warned them about pending arrests so that they could hide in time. His daughter's archive, personal archive that I was able to access, includes a letter from a Holocaust survivor who thanked her for her father saving his life, again, by warning of impending arrests. So all of this exculpatory evidence was then used in a trial in 1945 to acquit him of charges of collaboration, although he lost his law license and some other privileges. So what can I conclude from these contradictory archival documents? How should I judge him from the documents I found? Do I have an obligation to present in detail all of this information in order to do justice to his reputation? And what about the reputation of his descendants? Did archival documents I collected make a picture of his role in the first months of Nazi occupation in Serbia clearer or more muddled? So I want to end by saying that I tried to grapple with these and similar issues. And if anything, today I want to kind of make an appeal for you to treat archival documents not only as evidence or data that we use to write about, but also as information about something that really happened to people. Not an abstract conflict, but as living, in many cases, multi-generational trauma that we as researchers can further contribute to and deepen. So I'm going to end this piece of it. And then, as I said, if you guys have questions on this or on other parts of my method that's not always this gruesome, I'll be happy to talk about that too.
Excellent. I'll do exactly what I did for Ty. I'll pose a question to sort of start with. I was struck that in the early part of your remarks, you asked the rather provocative question, what if we think of the archival materials as people? But then the final formulation that you had was not thinking of them as people, but thinking of them as information about things that actually happened to people. There's an interesting gap there, an interesting sort of jump in between the two. I know when I've done archival work, what I've tended to do is to try to think of them not as persons, but try to think of them as speaking rather than as documents. Mm-hmm. So as sort of what is the act of performance that's being recorded mm-hmm. here on the page. So I'm curious about the slippage for you between sort of treating the elements as people and treating them as information about people, and sort of what's at stake in that for you.
Right. So I think I started by asking myself, how would I do this research differently if I did think of archives as people? Mm. And that's very difficult to do and implement, really, because we're dealing with dead people. I keep saying this, but it's kind of striking when you have material in front of you that you kind of need answers to, but you can never get them. So it's the ungettability of an answer that's really problematic. So in that sense, they cannot be... I wanted them to be people, but in the end, they ended up not being people. So they ended up being information about people. But I think what I still want to claim is that when I think of archives as people, I also think about the descendants. It was, for example, so it was super important for me to, as I was using some of this material, check with the children or grandchildren if it's okay that I put it in, even if it was published. So there was another letter that I didn't, there's many, many letters in this book, but one letter that I didn't read that's from a Holocaust victim who wrote a letter to his son as he knew that he was going to get killed. And this son then survived because he joined the partisan resistance in the forest and became a successful historian himself. And then 57 years after his father was murdered, somebody was collecting archival material. This is in Croatia, in the Zagreb National University Library, and found this letter and called the son, who was now in his 60s, and said, "We have this letter for you, please come." And it's one of the most amazing letters. It's all about, don't be sad, I've tried to teach you to be brave, but this is, you have to take care of the rest of your family. Basically, like, you have to be, he was 13, the son. You have to take care of your little brother, who's 10. So the 10-year-old also joined the partisans, and they both survived. I mean, it's a 13 and a 10-year-old who survived in the forest. And so this son, who found the letter, he died before I had a chance to interview him. He died in 2017. But his son is still living. He's in his 50s, and also a prominent historian. Now, all of this has been published and translates, published in English. It's published in the New York Review of Books. It's a kind of a big thing. And I still felt awkward about putting it again in a book. So I contacted the grandson, and I said, you know, is it okay? And he said, absolutely, you know, yes. So I did that with every single, if I could find descendants, with every single person who I could trace had some family. And I didn't have to do that. IRB didn't make me do it. My publisher didn't make me do it. It was not that. It just was, because it was such a harrowing process, this whole book writing was so horrible, that I felt like the last thing I want to do is then publish and have somebody read it and be like, oh, again, who is this woman? Like, what is she? Why is she publishing this? So I tried to do that at least and get some buy-in from the descendants. So that's what I mean, like, when I think of them as people, I think of them, you know, and that's also why I wanted to end with this, that this is a multi-generational trauma that we can make worse. Mm. So I wanted to make sure that I don't make it worse for somebody who, you know, buys a book at a fair and is like, that was my grandfather. I wish she's called me. So I did call them. I tried to call them, everybody.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I just have a question. You gave us a lot of questions to think about, right? And other than thinking of the humanity of the experiences of these people, did you use anything else to kind of help guide you in figuring out how to move these ethical partners?
Yes, yes, yes. I did. There is quite a lot of work in history and actually feminist history on ethics of doing Holocaust research. Now, none of that. Now, I should probably say why this is even IR. I should probably tell you guys, like, why am I even here? So just to give you an argument. I realized, I was like, why are they? So the main argument of the book is that states after external stress, in this case the stress of the end of communism, have an identity crisis, and they are caught between wanting to belong to Europe and to larger European narratives, and that one of the strongest European narratives is the narrative of the Holocaust. But they are pulled out of it by their own domestic problems and concerns, including a completely different political memory, which is memory of Stalinism and communism. So those two, after 1989, came to a head. So anyway, that's why it's in our book. But in that literature, there's a lot of stuff that I read about the method. And the feminist literature I thought was most useful also because it talked about like the ethic of care, which is what feminists care about how to approach Holocaust research, how to not reproduce, for example, numbering in databases. That was really interesting. There was an excellent article about don't put these people in a database and don't give them numbers because they've been numbered. And it was a really interesting, so I, you know, don't assign them numbers, because I presented part of this at another workshop, and somebody from the audience who comes from a very different tradition than we do here was like, well, you can solve all these ethical problems by just like assigning, anonymizing, you know, and I was like, yeah, that is exactly the opposite, like that's the, because these people have been anonymized and numbered, and there is a literature that I've used a lot of it in history and feminism about how to approach this kind of research, to even methodologically, like literally she's like, no database, just like no numbers, no, you know, these people have names, try to spell their names the way they spell their names and give each person like a voice, don't put like, you know, number 5. So, but there is that literature. None of it is really in IR, but a lot of this obviously is based on historical research, and people have thought about this. There's a lot of other research that I read on the ethics, for example, again from history, on how to use colonial archives, because you know you're using an archive on justice, and so what do you do when, like I think I was reading about Algeria, that like the entire, or Tunisia, I can't remember which, the entire archive is actually a colonial archive. And so how do people then negotiate the politics of why is this document there? Another thing I wanted to mention also, which I didn't get into presentation, another issue was, you know, there's a reason why some people end up in the archives and others don't. And so that also interested me. So archives, you know, people put people who they think are important in the archives. They're all white men, always. And they're always at some kind of position of power. But the gatekeeper, the archivist, has made the decision for me. And so that is really annoying, because I'm like, yeah, well, I want to know about these other people. And so for that, I had to do other stuff. So I had to, you know, get access to people's, like, personal archives and their family archives but that's also something I want you to think about, is like you go to an archive and then you see who's there, and you have to think about why they're there and not all these other people who also had stuff to say or should have been there. But the archivist didn't think that some nurse who was 19 years old belongs in an archive, even though her testimony, I think, was much more compelling than some commander. It's just not...
Yes.
Yeah, so this was a different, I mean, I've done archival stuff before, I've done interviews before. I've written a little bit about a slightly different issue that I had before. This is, and I'll talk about why this was the most difficult by far, but in my earlier work, I worked mostly on the Western Balkans, and so the countries where I'm from, and I speak the language. And I've written a piece that I can send people. It was published in PS a long time ago, where I talked about the problems of doing research on your own country. and the ethical issues that come with that, mostly not from my perspective, but from the perspective of how I was perceived and all of that. And so that was kind of an issue that I had to negotiate a little bit. And in that earlier work, it was a constant problem, me talking to people who I don't like and they don't like me, and then, you know, representing accurately what they said. It's always very difficult. But for this book, so I wanted to write this book for years, and I didn't really have the courage because I knew that it's going to be very traumatic for me. And also, I really was terrified of getting it wrong. I was like, talk about imposter syndrome. Who do you think you are writing a book on the Holocaust? Like, I would tell myself in the mirror, like, what do you think, you know? And so this just went on for like years and years. And then finally, what happened is that I wrote a paper on a tiny piece of it, just the one little art exhibition that I observed that made me think about it. And I presented it at, I don't know if it was here or a big ISA, it was in Baltimore. And Brent Steele, God bless him, said, was the discussant, and my paper was 65 pages, and he was like, I'm not reading this shit unless it's a book. I'm not reading 65 pages of anything. And I was like, come on. He was like, I'm not reading this. And so he was just like, I'm not reading it. So I was like, you think it can be a book? And he's like, write the damn book and then I'll read it. So I was like, okay. And then I kind of figured out. But I knew from the very beginning there would be a different kind of book. And it's written in a kind of crossover appeal so that like my in-laws can read it. That's the whole point. And I then had to deal with how... So when I talked to the editor, because I had a publisher, I kind of knew what this was going to look like and which publisher and everything. So I talked to the publisher and I said, can I write it like this? And are you okay with me putting myself in the book and talking also about how I'm feeling and also finding out material about my own family, which was not very flattering, and talking about how I'm feeling about, like, can I write a book like that you will publish? And he was like, sure. And so I wrote it like that. But I think that's a unique, I had a wonderful relationship with the editor who trusted me because they published my first book, so he kind of knew me. But that's, I think, after many years, there's an issue of trust there. But I wouldn't have written it, I think, if it had to be a very cold I just was not interested in that. I wanted something. But I had a lot of emotional problems, right? Because read this horrible testimony. It's just like really like you have nightmares. So I went, I talked to a rabbi, and I'm not Jewish. I have a rabbi in Atlanta, and I was like, I need to talk to somebody. Like, is this disrespect? Am I being disrespectful to you? Like, I tried. I talked to people. Nobody said it was disrespectful. People were always very supportive. But I tried to actually deal with all of these problems that I was having. Some of them from imposter, like who are you to write about this? You're not even a historian. To who are you? You're not Jewish. Like, what are you doing? Like, this is insulting. To you're gonna lose your damn mind. So there's like a gamut there, and I tried to talk to different people throughout. All of my friends know about the book. Everybody's like, okay, is it published already? Jesus. So there's a lot of that. Tried to find out as much as I could about this journalist. But it's a strange thing. So he wrote these and then hid them in lemonade bottles. Then he was shot, found dead in the forest. And then only after the war, one of the Holocaust survivors from Lithuania found them, like dug them up, and then translated them in 91. So it's very strange. I mean, the whole thing is kind of bizarre. And so I tried to find out what historians discerned about his motivation, and it's inconclusive. It seems that there's some evidence that he was also a member of the Polish anti-Nazi resistance, and maybe that's why he was killed, so that's like a good thing. But I did leave the question in there. So I use this description because he has The reason why we know what happened is because of his diary, because there were no survivors at Quantity. There were 12 people who survived out of 72,000. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And so he has very vivid descriptions, so that's why I used it. But I did say in that section where I talk about it that I'm troubled by the unemotional tone. And so then I talked to the head of the Jewish community in Lithuania, and she said, yes, what he said was correct. And because she says that her grandmother remembered that a lot of these clothes that this Jewish, especially Jewish women, were asked to strip the clothes, and then the Lithuanians would take the clothes back to churches, and then Lithuanian non-Jews would go and take the bloody clothes, cut out the yellow star, put something else, and wear them. And so I put all that in that whole section. So I have this, and then I have what a person told me this February in Vilnius from her grandmother's testimony. So I kind of pieced it together from all of these sources.
Yes.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that. My own archival work is, well, thankfully, a lot more boring and mundane. It's bureaucratic trade documents between the EU and East Africa in the 1960s. And I do think there are some ethical considerations, like colonial archives, but for the most part, it's much more boring and doesn't have all this dramatic stuff. And I think the main ethical issue I wrestle with when I'm doing my own archival stuff is, as someone who's probably the only person to ever look at these very boring trade documents, how much responsibility do I have to give the counter argument to my own arguments, right? So if I think that these, it's kind of what we're just getting at, but if I think that the reason this trade treaty got signed is XYZ, but there's someone else who thinks it's AB, and as I'm going through, like, the evidence is 70-30, that it was for the reasons I think. Like, how do we ever, as like, if you think you're the only person who's going to read these things, like, how much do you have to give the other side of the story, even if it massively complicates your narrative, makes it longer? Or at what point can you be reasonably certain that you have made a good faith effort to interpret the data and confirm whatever it is, knowing that you also heard confirmation bias? I don't know if I missed the question.
Yeah, no, I know. That's really interesting. So, but if you're the only person who has read them, then how can there be an alternative explanation based on different kind of data?
Yeah, so, like, you know, it was this treaty that Europe tried to exploit East Africa, or is it, you know, a mutually consented treaty between both of them that may not be perfectly equal, but roughly equal? And so the alternative explanations exist out there. Thus far, I'm the only one who I've ever looked at.
But that's what I would say. I would say the existing explanations are that the treaty was signed based on this. However, nobody has looked at original archival documents that I have, and based on this, my interpretation is this.
Okay. That's, so you don't necessarily need to undermine your own argument just to play devil's advocate with yourself.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think as long as you cite others and you say, you know, the existing explanations lead us to say, and the person A and B and C have pushed forward this argument. However, I have done my own primary archival research, which contradicts this, and this is what I found. That's what I would end it. I mean, you have to, you know, make do. You don't want somebody to say, well, there's a completely different argument, blah, blah, blah. You know this, and you have cited it. And you can say in a sentence what that argument is, but then develop your own story. And people can then go and read that other person. And...
Is that a two finger, sir?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think this concern for me comes up not in archival research as much, although it's pertinent, but for interviews. If I am having a conversation with someone, then it's unlikely that exact conversation will ever be replicated. Wrestling to do with, have some word limits, and in the interest of economy and cohesion.
80 documents I looked at, 50 seem to support this, but there are these other examples.
And then some of that also speaks sort of to the epistemic status of what it is you're trying to generate. If you're trying to make a general claim, then discrepant evidence is evidence against. If you're trying to produce a compelling reading in a more hermeneutic style, then those things that are discrepant simply suggest that your interpretation might need to be tweaked a little bit because you're sort of trying to cover the whole thing. So there's a difference sort of in terms of like what exactly do we want to do with it, arising from the same sense of responsibility, but then what do you do with that sense of responsibility? Again, how do we sort of cash that out methodologically? There are some different options that we can engage in. And I think it'd be interesting when Sarah's turn is to talk. So I think Sarah comes at some of this stuff a little bit differently than our two previous presenters in terms of the inductive and hermeneutic aspects versus the more hypothesis testing kind of approach to thinking about knowledge production, which is part of why, you know, because we love diversity here. That's why we want to have lots of different people doing lots of different things. Did you have a hand before?
I did.
You did? Cool. And then after that, we're going to stop, even though it's a couple minutes early. But we'll do that, and we'll take a long coffee break, and then come back.
So one thing that I'm sure that you probably ran across is, as you were looking through these archival documents, maybe having like contradictory interpretations of things, or maybe even in the example that you're talking about with the journalist, maybe things that, like as you're piecing together a narrative, kind of like who this person was or what their actions were, like how did you go about actually like stitching together that and making a determination about like what was relevant in the archival research that helps like create a larger picture of this, and maybe what was more auxiliary or maybe not as relevant. I guess like, and how did you make the decisions of like where you were going to look for those things to like construct the narrative?
Right. No, this is excellent, and it's. So this is the thing that I think I mentioned is like when I realize that I'm the curator of these documents, and that is a huge burden, and you know, and so I'm writing now this narrative of these people, and you know, and then I'm picking stuff that's more interesting and also based on the languages I speak. So, you know, there's a whole thing. So my book has three case studies, country studies, Serbia, Croatia, which is the language I speak. So I'm like, okay, I can go and do everything and read and blah, blah. The third case is Lithuania, and it's a language I don't speak. And also most of the testimonies that were interesting were in Yiddish, which I definitely don't speak. And so there, I had to rely on secondary sources. And I went to like the closest to I could, which is like, there's a YouTube channel, this poor professor in Lithuania, God bless him, who's done like hundreds of interviews in Yiddish with Yiddish survivors over the last 20 years. And he had no time or money to transcribe them, but he has a YouTube. It's like for any student, I'm like, oh my God, like what you can do with this. And so like, that's what the closest, so I was like, guys, this is it. Like, but I could then rely on the summaries that he gave me in English that we talked about. But that's a failing on my part in that particular case study because I don't speak either, none of the languages. So that's part the issue. Partly, I think, is what I said earlier in the comment when Ty was speaking. Like, I didn't decide ahead of time what I'm going to do. I was writing, and then as I was writing, I was like, you know, I really need to find out more about how this particular museum, because a lot of what my book talks about is how remembrance practices have changed after the end of communism. So how museum displays and exhibits look different now than they did 10 years ago and 20 years ago. But that, you know, so then as I'm writing, I'm like, okay, well, I actually need to go and find this. And so I didn't go with a particular set of either documents or questions deductively, really, to be honest. That's just not how it went. And so it was more like trying to find different things that would piece things together as I was in the field. I think that's more how the process went.
I do want to follow up.
Yeah, please.
I also am wondering, too, did you run into any instances where maybe the descendants of somebody had a very different picture of vision than what you found in the archive documents? And if so, how did you navigate that?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
So this, again, is mostly for Lithuania. So Lithuania has a very doctrinaire historiography, and that's the reason why I actually chose this case, because it's the one that comes closest to a version of Holocaust denial, where it's basically, they have this whole argument about double genocide, which is that like Jews killed Lithuanians first because they supported communist Soviet Union, and so when then the Nazis came, it's not a surprise that they killed all the Jews. I mean, that's like the national narrative at elite level. And so there's it's very difficult to find Lithuanian historiography that doesn't have that. And so I put that in the book, and because that's part of what I'm talking about, and I'm saying I found all these documents through these like, you know, video testimonies and some of the survivor testimonies and histories are different, but the Lithuanian historiography claims this. And then I said what Lithuanian historiography claims, and I cited the main authors who claim this, and then I have, and this is why they're wrong, because all of the other evidence and other research and research from other countries points that this is not what happened. The Jews were not killed because they were communists, they were killed because they were Jews, and you can tell yourselves all you want, but that's just not what happened. But I have a lot of, about what is the state of historiography that is completely contradictory to what
I'm saying.
Yeah.
Is that also how it's like a similar thing you would just account for, like, here's what there is?
Yes. Okay. There's a lot of that. Like, you know, like this unit is perceived as heroes and they have monuments all over the place, but in fact, this is what that's a lot.
Yeah. And playing around in that gap just makes the ethical questions
even sharper
in some ways.
Yes.
So, lots of questions, lots of things to grapple with. And if you get nothing else out of this workshop, then like a variety of things to grapple with, and I think we're all doing our jobs.
And you can study anything you want.
Excellent.
Believe me, if I can do this, you can do anything.
Excellent. Well, join me in thanking Elena.